The outcome that you want and the outcome that others want don't always align. Symptoms would come forward as feeling no way to measure the success of your own decision.
How much of the decision making is kind of done for us and is happening at an unconscious level?
It puts you completely in the driving seat because you determine that outcome for yourself. But that's easier said than done, because what is that outcome and how do you define it? Money can be confused with happiness, right? If I asked you, would 10 million pounds make you happy? It's really easy to say, oh, 10 million pounds is a lot of money. The only thing that leads to human kind of unhappiness and human anxiety is uncertainty. When you're sitting in that job that you hate and it's weighing on you, that when you resign, you mean, I've resigned not even having another job. And that felt like it was going to lead to real anxiety. And I felt the most relief.
Is there a framework that you follow would suggest for people to make better decisions?
I personally find to be a fantastic tool for those that already know how to do things.
If we were creating a dummy's guide to decision making, I guess where would you start?
Oh, good question. I guess I would start with...
Steve Himan. How are you?
Yeah, good. Thanks. Thanks for having me here, and nice to be here.
Yeah, pleasure. Pleasure. I'm really excited for this one. So we always start our podcast off the same way. Who are you and what problem do you solve?
So I'm Steve Himan, or Human, depending on what the mood set takes you. I'm a senior associate behavioral economist at the FCA. I guess you could say I'm a well-versed behavioral economist, and then formerly just a researcher, and even before that, a scientist. What problem do I solve? I won't be as grandiose to say I solve it, but I guess the problem I'm trying to help solve is to help people kind of navigate the intricacies of decision-making in our complex world, and doing that through kind of regulation in the finance space.
Amazing. Okay. And typically, what are the symptoms someone might be experiencing if they're trying to navigate those decisions that make it worthwhile them staying tuned for the rest of the episode?
Oh, good question. I mean, I think that the symptoms in general would be self-doubt, lack of clarity in their decision-making. You know, the feeling of that there's too many decisions to make and not having any way to navigate those decisions in a quantifiable way, if that makes any sense. I guess symptoms would come forward as feeling no way to measure the success of your own decisions, right? Because almost every decision has a measurable effect on you. And I guess kind of the inability to measure that those decisions that we make on a daily basis. I guess, you know, we can take that all the way down to, should I have a coffee? Should I run for this train, which is one of my favorite thought experiments? You know, should I push for that promotion? Should I take credit to, you know, further myself financially in my mind? Yeah.
Good. Interesting. So, Steve, I don't know if you remember, but in the noughties, my mom used to have a massive bookcase of these, but like an idiot's guide. So I think she had like an idiot's guide to using Microsoft Word and an idiot's guide to Judaism, all these things.
Word for dummy.
Dummy's guide. Yeah, that was it. Maybe they didn't use the word idiot. They'd be cancelled now for that one. So if we were creating a dummy's guide to decision-making, I guess... where would you start?
Oh, good question. I guess I would start with the outcome, right? You know, if we look at decision making in economics, the outcome is essentially what defines the success of the decision. Now, in economics, the decision, the outcome is usually a financial benefit, right? The kind of idea of economics is to get the most that you can using the least resource. And a decision, and actually, interestingly enough, those decisions are quite easy for people to tease apart, right? You know, should I take job A or B, and A is £10,000 more than B? a lot of the times people will go for job A because that seems like a very easy decision to make economically. And the economist probably would say, definitely do that. But that's not how behavioral economics works, right? And that's not how the outcomes reflect for us as human beings. There's a term in economics, utility, which is actually more like akin to happiness. And yeah, so for me, the idiot's guide to decision making and how to kind of approach that is develop your outcome to the point where you fully understand that outcome. Now, that's easier said than done. And I don't want anyone to think that I'm saying that that's an easy thing to do. So let's say I'm deciding whether or not to go on holiday, and I'm deciding between, I don't want to use specific examples because I don't want to make any, but let's say I'm deciding between kind of Dubai and South Africa, right? There's actually an interesting thing I've seen in sales training, which is kind of setting out your expected outcomes for different points. So like there's the essentials that I need. So like the essential I need when I'm going on holiday is, let's say, sunshine. Okay, great. So Dubai and South Africa both cover that. The ideal, the next level would be that it's affordable and I get to spend a lot of time outside, right? So, okay, you know, we're already starting to see that South Africa and Dubai probably look a bit different. And then optimum, I get to feel like I'm in a culture that I'm very familiar with. And all of the other things, remember, like these obviously build out. So now I've actually taken a decision on holidays, broken it down into essentially a quantifiable measure, which isn't money. It wasn't this cost this and this cost that. And now I can kind of interpret my decision with understanding the outcome that is actually optimum to me. Does that make sense? And maybe I strayed away from the dumb guide, but
no, it was good. It was good. People are going to be in the listening on their commute, thinking, "Yeah, South Africa sounds like a good idea." You've sold it, Steve. And
definitely.
The way that you were the way that you were talking there, it felt like some of the examples you were giving were quite. And this is kind of one of the things that I've been thinking about recently and trying to get my head around when it comes to decision making. It's very binary. Should I take this job or this job? Should I go to this place or this place? So decision-making, I think, and I'm no expert, that's why you're on the podcast, Steve, but it feels like it's usually binary. Is it a one? Is it a zero? What path do I go down? What are your thoughts and take on that?
That's a very interesting point. I mean, the term choice sets is a term that comes around a lot, right? Because you're right, it's not binary. And I think so now you've raised a really good point, right? So now I've said South Africa and Dubai, but you increase that choice set to, let's call it 10 places. I'm not going to embarrass myself geographically because I probably can't come up with 10 places off the top of my head to think about, but all of those measures remain the same, right? The sunshine, or the weather that I'm looking for, the cultural experience I'm looking for. And we all have these preferences, and some preference might not matter at all, right? To the infinitely rich, the cost might be irrelevant. But interestingly enough, that could be replaced by status in their preference, in the preferences that make up kind of how you evaluate which of these choices is best for you. The way I look at it is, if you keep the principles of quantifying each of the choices the same, which is aligning, trying to measure your preference set across the choices, then they become completely comparable. And then essentially they are a binary comparison between each, one to another. Even saying that, let's say I've got these 10 things and I can kind of intuitively create, let's call it a score. And then I can narrow it down to two or three. And we've all done this, right? So people do, they look at jobs and the jobs, they're not 10 grand apart, they're a grand apart. And immediately they go into, okay, how far is my commute? What are the hours? How did I feel about the interview? They'll even have the follow-up discussion with like the manager. How do I feel about the person managing? And you can see how quickly it goes away from this economic measure, which is really easy. And like I said, right, the brain is a very I'll say this loosely. The brain has a lot of rationality in it. It seeks to achieve something with the least effort at first, right? So the easiest way to decide between two things is this really easy thing we have, which is a quantifiable measure of money, which is why often, you know, money can be confused with happiness, right? If I asked you, would 10 million pounds make you happy? It's really easy to say, oh, 10 million pounds is a lot of money. But it's really hard to say what happiness is. So no, they're not binary. But actually, if you kind of look at these, this quantifiable preference set, which is essentially a regression, a utility function, we don't have to go kind of too far into that. But using that principled way of filtering your decisions to again, focus on your outcome. And your outcome could be completely different to mine. And I think that's also where, you know, talking to your friends can be a confusing aspect to this, right? Because when you talk to someone about going on holiday, they don't talk about it the way I'm talking about it. They don't go, yes, I would like to go on holiday with A, B, C, D, E, F, G prioritized preferences. They'll be like, yeah, but I mean, I love Dubai. Why would you not want to go to Dubai? I'm like, well, South Africa fits my preferences better. So no, they're not binary, but I guess good decision-making requires that you filter down to a at least comparable choice set where those preferences can be measured and are accumulated to the highest outcome value for you, right? I hope that answers the question or at least gets towards answering.
Yeah. Yeah, really good, really good. It's getting the cogs going already. One of the things that I was thinking about then was the decisions that we make, sometimes it feels like we're quite hackable, particularly in the modern world. So the algorithm is feeding you exactly what you like. Advertisers are feeding you exactly what you already like. It almost feels like we're being just dragged from one decision to another without being behind the steering wheel. So I suppose from your work, how much of the decision-making is kind of done for us and is happening at an unconscious level?
Yeah, it's another good question. I mean, I guess that's why you guys do this, because you're asking me questions. I won't delve into kind of unconscious and conscious, because that's not my wheelhouse and not my expertise. But in terms of kind of what's driving the decisions, I think it's a really, really good point. So the kind of the way that I'm talking about it and looking at it, and this is again like an ideal way to do it. I'm not even suggesting I do it this way every time. It puts you completely in the driving seat because you determine that outcome for yourself, right? But that's easier said than done, because what is that outcome and how do you define it? So if I ask you, what's a lot of money? You can't answer that question without a reference point, right? You know, or with asking some clarification questions, like, do you mean, what is a lot of money to live in the UK? What is a lot of money for your first job? What is a lot of money if you earn £1 million a month? What is a lot of money to a footballer? Like, so that already comes into kind of anchoring in the fact that we as humans, we're comparison engines, right? We're always doing this thing where we're kind of creating a reference point for ourselves and then developing like an idea of how to improve on that. And that's actually really interesting, because if you go and look at kind of the poorest countries in the world, there will still be a lot of happy people. And the richest countries in the world, there's still a lot of unhappy people. And that's because it's a reference point thing. So the way I kind of try to disentangle this, because you're right, that the outcome that you want and the outcome that others want don't always align. And that is where the modern world is kind of, there's this ability to impact supply and demand through, as you say, kind of interfering with decision making. So, I don't know, let's say I'm like, if I just asked you, Zach, do you want this crate of tomatoes? I'll use tomatoes because I think it's the supply and demand example in most economics textbooks, or at least the one that I've seen lately. I'm like, do you want this crate of tomatoes? And you're like, straight away, there's an outcome for you. Like, do I want tomatoes? Do I not want tomatoes? And you say, no. Okay. So that's essentially supply and demand in its purest form. And I'm supplying the tomatoes and you don't want them. Then I'm like, you go, yeah, you do want them. And I'm like, okay, cool. how much would you be willing to pay for them? And now we align on a supply and demand price, and you pay £10 for the creative tomatoes. That's a really clear way, right? There's an outcome for you, which is you want to buy tomatoes. There's an outcome for me. Now, I actually have an ability to influence your outcome. And that's where it gets a lot more difficult, because I can start going, your friends buy tomatoes. Why don't you buy tomatoes? Now I'm starting to actually input some new information into how you develop your outcome. So the way I kind of disentangle these things is looking at the motivation for the decision and trying to keep my motivations and my outcomes at the center of how I make decisions. And that's kind of also what I try to do. That, as you asked, what problem am I trying to solve? I'm trying to help those interacting with financial products keep their well-being, their motivations, their outcomes at the center of the decisions they make. So, yeah, it's not easy, right? Because we all want different things, and that's natural. This is not to kind of say that there's malice or nefarious approaches. There obviously are. There are nefarious approaches. I mean, think about the scam message that I'm sure we've all seen, which is like you have a package from DPD waiting, and which I think is an unbelievably smart scam, and I think it's caught a lot of people, and definitely almost caught me. The motivation of the person sending you that is very different to the motivation of yourself, that they've realized they can hinge that motivation on your outcome. The outcome is you want your package. Yeah, I think I got quite convoluted there, but
No. It's a great answer. You're giving such good answers that there's many different roads that I can take, which is always good. So I want to go back to a point that you made earlier. You said it's quite hard if someone asked you what happiness is to define that, and I agree with that. But then I find that if you said to me what is unhappiness, that feels easy. I could feel like I could rattle off a load of things what unhappiness is. Do you think that's because we're innately negatively wired, or is there something else happening there that makes that so?
Oh, what a good question. I mean, I'm going to give you an answer off the top of my head. I don't have any previous exact, like, explicit work or views or research on this. It's a really good question. I'm a big fan of evolutionary behavioral thinking, right? So kind of a lot of the heuristics and ways we think and the structures to how we think are very much driven by the thousands and thousands and thousands of years of evolution and have come from keeping us alive. So the first thing I thought when you said that is, if you just go back to the caveman era, and I'm not an anthropologist, so please don't ask me when that is and how long ago it was. And anyone listening, please don't crucify me. What kept you alive more efficiently? Knowing what was dangerous or knowing what was really good for you? Probably the former. So it's interestingly, like you say, are we negatively wired? I think we're just wired to know what would harm us better than what might not, which is kind of like a self-preservation mechanism. And probably mentally, we have that in the same way, right? Because I think the psychology and the way we think and make decisions is directly tied to that evolution. That's my opinion. So as you put it, it's very easy for me to go, ooh, that harms me. And I know at a baseline how to keep myself safe. Essentially, if we take the examples, like, that thing there is dangerous. Those berries kill me. Staying out in the cold in the dark puts me in danger. If you think about a silly example, but when turning off the lights and going up the stairs, it like brings a natural fear into yourself because of being followed, right? And that probably comes from the idea of walking with your back towards dark spaces puts you in danger back in the day. So that's a really good point. And I think, yes, to answer directly and succinctly, yes, I think we are negatively wired, but I think it's because that is what's kept us alive. And then there's this flip side, which is far more open, creative, and more challenging. It's not this heuristic, this rule of thumb, this open-ended ability to optimize infinitely, which then in the modern world leads to like greed and capitalism and that sort of thing. Because if, you know, there's always this question: is like, if you've grown to £10 million and you've tripled every year for 5 years, why not stop? Right? And I guess that's the flip side of it: is that you were never supposed to stop in caveman times, because the only thing that would actually stop you is resource availability, and you could never actually achieve. You could never achieve so many tomatoes that you could eat yourself to death. But technology and intellectual growth just outpaces anything that evolution or genetics can do, and then creates this problem where like the optimizing thinking actually has its own pitfalls.
Nice. So if people are trying to, because you've been doing this a long time, Steve, so you're probably the perfect person to ask, but if people are trying to tackle those human biases and they're trying to kind of get inside their own mind, is there a framework that you follow or would suggest for people to make better decisions?
Good question. I don't think it's a framework, because I mean, I wish it was as easy as that, but it isn't. I mean, if it was, I think, and there are a lot of people on YouTube and Instagram that peddling that there is, it is as easy as that. I think it's, you know, we talk about sludge and friction and kind of hot and cold states in behavioral economics. And I think these are all very valid terms. So like sludge is, you know, something that you don't want in a process or a system that creates that, that makes it harder to do. Friction is kind of when you introduce, whether on purpose or not, kind of things that slow people down in their decision making. A good example of this is if you look at CFD trading, you know, some of the sites will have kind of a test just to understand if you kind of can actually do the very basics of the trading, and that's a friction step, and in fact they actually could just drop you out if you're unable to do it. And then there's these kind of hot and cold states, right? So you know, let me think about it this way. Oh, okay, like if you're sitting on your couch at home thinking about buying a car, you know, that's a cold state. You're quite far from the decision and you can kind of think through it clearly. In a hot state, you're in the showroom and you're being told that this car is like, it's going off the lot. It's your dream car. You like it. It's going off the lot today, right? Now, immediately, you're going to make very different decisions about that exact same car. So to come back to your question, I don't think it's a framework. I think it's taking stock of the outcome and the decision you're making and trying to kind of remove yourself from any hot state thinking. Because it's a hot state when you're susceptible to someone else driving the decision. Cold state, you're far less susceptible. It's not that you're not susceptible at all, but yeah. And I think that's kind of how I go about it and how I think about it. It's a really good question, because I do a lot of work in very specific settings, so I don't always think about it conceptually like this, and a framework for better decision making. But yeah, that's kind of where I land on it. I know that's not the best answer and not the most helpful, and it doesn't give anyone anything to take away and increment. But
no, I think it's a good answer, and I think it's when you were saying that, it was making me think about like cotton hold states. That's a brilliant. I think that's a question that you can ask yourself. Am I in a cold state? Am I in a hot state? And that will probably lead to, obviously, we're sales guys, a bit of buyer's remorse. Like, have you been kind of hoodwinked into buying something that you didn't need? When you said the word friction, and I don't want to sound like a teenage clickbaity YouTube title, but when I think about decisions, you must have seen it as well. Like, Steve Jobs only wears this T-shirt every single day of the week to minimize decisions, et cetera, et cetera. So decision fatigue, is decision fatigue a real thing? What can people be doing to improve that? Are there kind of hindrances to making lots and lots of decisions? How do you optimize your life when it comes to decision making?
Yeah, it's absolutely a thing. It absolutely exists. I mean, cognitive load is the term that is used, I think, kind of in the academia. But you're you know, in my mind and my take on all of this is your brain is essentially a computer, right? And there is only so much RAM and there's only so much hard drive space, and there is only so much you can do. And that has changed over time and how much you're expected to do, right? And the capability of the computers of our mind have not kept up with that. It's a really good point in how do you optimize this and how do you protect yourself from decision overload, right? And I think that's a really hard one to answer. I don't personally find it taxing to decide what I'm wearing in the morning. But that being said, I'm not the most fashionable and I probably do wear the same 3-4 outfits on repeat. So maybe I'm doing it without even realizing. So the first thing I would say is stop taking on decisions for other people or decisions that aren't yours, because that's a surefire way to kind of overburden yourself cognitively. So that's really hard for parents because obviously they have to do it. But in friendships, relationships, for me, and this is really going into kind of just my personal views, but you know, I find it, and I'm sure we've all had this experience, you want to kind of meet up with a friend, but then they don't have any idea what they want to do and you don't have any idea what you want to do. And then you kind of get into this kind of issue where you're like, okay, now I have to do the thinking for both of us and I have to think about where we go for dinner and what, you know, that's the classic joke, like, what do you want for dinner? I don't know. And then you kind of put something forward and then the person goes, I actually don't want that. And you're like, well, it's what you were saying earlier, Zach. It's like, you know what you don't want, but you don't know what you do want. Let's focus on getting to what you do want and then we can compromise to a happy medium. So I have quite severe boundaries on these things. Like I will quite vocally resist taking on others' cognitive burdens. And then I think also I kind of cut things down as much as I can in my daily life, especially, you know, small things like I'll eat the same lunch every day and but this is very important. I don't have a preference. I'm not a variety food kind of person. So that doesn't affect me, but it does mean that I don't have to do this additional kind of decision-making. I think if you're starting to feel overwhelmed by decision-making, cut it down to the decisions that seem to kind of make you happy. Or let's not use the word happy, that make you feel good. And decisions that don't take away from you and from your energy every day. Again, like I didn't want to oversimplify this and just go cut back your decisions, right? Because that's the simple answer. So you'd be feeling overloaded, take less decisions off the table. But that's a very difficult, it's a very reductive very reductive answer. But I think start to identify which of these decisions, because I find if I go into picking a golf course, that does not require any work for me because I love looking at different golf courses. So, and that's the thing. I bet people that love food, when they're picking their lunch, that actually might be like an energy developing action. And again, we go back to that kind of list of preferences that are different between us and across people, which again is why it might be hard for people to identify in themselves what they're doing that is overloading, because there are other people in their social groups need to love these things. So yeah, I think it's coming down to kind of identifying the different types of decisions you're making and cutting the ones that are just unnecessary, right? Deciding on how you get to work, where one is 3 minutes different than another, you know, to another, but that's all that is different. Maybe just cut that decision in and just take the 3-minute loss or gain and know that that evens out over time. And just cut that decision out of your mind and have a relaxed commute because you haven't had to think about, oh, was that the right decision? Oh, I'm checking the Jubilee line rather than the Overground, and you know, rather than just having your coffee and walking to the one that seems at that moment to take your fancy. So cutting out those decisions that are just completely irrelevant and then starting to identify the decisions that actually add value to your life or energy, and then very much focusing on the decisions that need to be made. So a big example of that is people aren't focusing on the decisions to make to invest in pensions. And I know pensions is a boring topic, but it's actually really important. And that's because they're so overloaded by these other decisions. They're not engaging, they're keeping their head in the sand with decisions that actually are super important. And if you could cut out all of the ones that are really just unnecessary and maybe start putting that effort into the ones that are really important and will become very important to you then, like in the next 20 years. Yeah, you could first of all cut down how much of that overload there is, but also find all the stuff that's getting used, or the energy that's getting used, the RAM that's getting used into something that'll benefit you a lot more.
Nice. It made me think about, I don't want to oversimplify for anyone listening, but I heard a thing that basically was saying anxiety is up in the modern world because anxiety is often being overloaded with potential decisions that you could make and ended up making none. So absolutely. That can be a big reason why we're seeing increases in that way.
So I have a theory that is maybe proven in literature. I haven't looked into it, but the only thing that leads to human kind of unhappiness and human anxiety is uncertainty. That's why insurance exists, right? We will actually pay money to remove uncertainty. It fits into our utility function in a measurable economic way. I don't know how often, you know, let's say you're sitting in a job you don't like. I don't know if others can kind of identify or relate to this, but it's so interesting that when you're sitting in that job that you hate and it's weighing on you, that when you resign, you mean I've resigned not even having another job. And that's felt like it was going to lead to real anxiety. And I felt the most relief ever. It's like, you know, you're in a relationship that you're not happy with. Either deciding to forgive whatever happened in that relationship or end it, both lead to relief and happiness. But sitting in the middle of those two decisions is what leads to anxiety and unhappiness. And as you say, right, so now you've got infinitely more decisions that you've ever had. So infinitely more chance to feel uncertain, which infinitely more chance to feel anxious. But there is this additional thing. Once you're overloaded, you hit this like paralysis state, right, where you just make no decisions. And I'm a very linear thinker. If I find myself not being able to solve one problem, all the problems down the line start to suffer. And that's why I personally have to be very careful to keep that decision-making set optimized and very efficient, because if I have an issue now, you know, and that these issues could be things that you know family life or kind of emotional struggles that you need to solve. So yeah, no, it's a great point, and I have very strong feelings that kind of action and decision, whether right or wrong, often remove that anxiety. And if they're the wrong decisions, they just teach you what was wrong and you get to kind of move forward in a better way anyway. Granted, I'm obviously, this doesn't apply to those that are like in really bad situations, right? I'm like the wrong decision and the decision is things like self-harm or anything like that. That's not, I'm kind of keeping that in the confines of non-psychologically damaging scenarios or mental health issues or clinical mental health issues. But yeah, no, I think it's a really good point. And it's obviously it's becoming so much more clear with social media and just even the number of decisions. Just remove social media. There's more decisions on the table than there ever have been. And that's a great thing, is because we're developing and we're evolving and technology is on the rise and there's more options. And from an economic point of view, that's a great place to be, right? But from a behavioral economic point of view, exactly what you just said, Zach, it applies.
So you mentioned then about technology being on the rise, and it's probably come up a couple of times in the conversation. AI is very much the hot topic. Everyone's talking about it. Some people think they're doing it when they're not. There's all sorts of weird and wonderful things happening. But there seems to be two tribes that people fall in, and we'll talk about them like this because it feels like the extreme ends. One is AI is us bringing a god into the world that will one day bring about our extinction, and we'll be running from it in a Terminator-style scenario. The other is a Jimmy Carr outlook, that the comedian Jimmy Carr said AI is a covers band, and it will always be a covers band. You'll always need the person who came up with the idea at the forefront. So for you, which side of the fence do you fall on, or is it neither?
I mean, I'm probably more central, but probably leaning maybe closer to Jimmy Carr's version. But I am very polite to ChatGPT just in case, right? I'm hedging my bets. So the AI overlords do rise, they'll remember that I was very polite. I think it's such a meta problem, right? Because like we created it in his, let's just stick to ChatGPT because I don't know enough about the broader AI landscape to speak to it, my opinions on it. But let's say ChatGPT, right? Like it has access to everything that we've ever written. But it itself is presenting information. So we are now using everything we wrote, but using ChatGPT's view of it to now write new things. And then it is using that to kind of reinforce its own model. So there's already this like cyclical problem of it affecting itself and our interaction with it, generating more content than probably has ever been generated before, because it can generate content that I don't even know what the factor of increase is. I personally find AI currently to be a fantastic tool for those that already know how to do things. I think if you think about the distribution of ability, let's say there's people that are like on a scale currently of 1 to 10 in their field of how good they are at it. I think the people that are sitting at like 2 and 3 will move up to 4 and 5. Because they're getting this help from AI. The people that are sitting at like 6 and 7 but aren't using AI correctly will actually come closer to 4 and 5. So you're getting this, like the middle group getting squeezed together, because the people that maybe aren't as competent are getting a little bit more help, but the people that aren't as extraordinary are becoming a little bit more average because they're just using what is generated by AI. But the people that sit at 10 are moving to like 12. Because they are now just using everything they know in their expertise and have access to the best assistant you could ever have. But they're not using what AI says as a silver bullet, right? So I might agree with the cover band for you, but it's like a cover band with the best guitarist you've ever had, the best drummer you've ever had, the best vocalist you've ever had, but you still have to make sure you write good music for it. And you are essentially still the musician, right? You are essentially still writing the notes. And if you let it write the notes, well, then you will still get very average music performed by very good musicians.
I like that a lot. I heard something the other day when people talk about AI, and it was, I think, a young man went to a job interview and was being asked questions, was actually struggling to answer the questions halfway through because they were like, can I be honest with you? A lot of the time when I'm asked questions, I rely on AI to help me answer them. And I was doing an exercise the other day with some friends. They were talking about investment, and they were talking about like the pros and cons. I was like, well, just use AI to kind of list everything, give it a very specific example. So is there a fear that you can get AI to do a lot of the heavy lifting when it comes to decision making, and all of a sudden, actually, we might lose the ability to make great decisions?
Yeah, I mean, that is definitely a risk, right? So the data science world has been and will be further completely overhauled by AI, right? So AI, one thing AI is incredible at, ChatGPT, is at coding. because coding is a very structured algorithmic approach with very specific rules and very specific language. And obviously that's what it's fantastic at. So I've coded in Python, R, Stata. But I was, before AI, so I've had to go and figure out how those languages work at the base of them. And I've never been a data scientist, but I am now much more able to go into data science because now I don't need to know all of the coding languages. I just need to understand how coding works. But at the end of the day, I still can read the code and understand the logical flows and the reason that this code may not work. Whereas someone who has never done the hard coding will never be able to kind of put that lens on it. And yes, they could still write very, very good code. But the best data scientists are still going to understand clustering analysis, segmentations, kind of multi-level analysis better than anyone who has never done the core of data science. And again, they will be the good musicians with the great bands. And you're right. Like I'm not close enough to the younger generations, right, that have had that technology all the way through university. But it does appear, as you're saying, that there are people who are going to lose that ability. But I guess what I said about that distribution, right, all that's going to do is that the people that are sitting at the 10, the people that are still really focused on getting understanding are just now going to be even more exceptional. So overall, you're probably bringing the average down, as you say, because people aren't able to make the decisions. But then you'll still get these outliers who will now just seem closer to genius, right? Because they're just doing the understanding. And there's this thing, you spoke about investments, right? There's this thing I've always thought about. If you can't explain something simply, you don't understand it. And I mean, I might have just put my foot in it because I hope I've explained things simply here. But that you lose that, right? So if you're putting in to ChatGPT, give me the principles of investing, but you've never really understood what the principles of investing are, like understanding why, well, first of all, understanding expected value theory to a very basic level, understanding fundamental value, understanding portfolio interactions, then you might read those things and go, oh, yeah, like I could do investing, but you'll never fully understand it, right? And if someone just asks you what is fundamental value or what is expected value theory, they wouldn't be able to explain it to you and why it applies to investing, right?
It's making me think. I saw something on social media the other day that you can now get an app or something with headphones where it will translate and then you can say what you want to say back in a different language. That doesn't necessarily mean that you can speak French. And so there's some beautiful takeaways. Steve, I've absolutely loved this conversation. I think one of the things that you spoke about was decision-making boundaries. I think I'm going to carry that with me moving forward. And I think actually, yeah, you shouldn't be making decisions for friends or family members. So when Zach texts me tomorrow saying, what should I have for lunch? There's a new boundary in place.
Sorry, I need to stop doing that.
Steve, thank you so much for joining us. I've loved this conversation. If people want to check you out, get in touch with you, where can they find you?
I'm not very big on any kind of social media. So if they are interested, just LinkedIn. Yes, Stephen James Human, FCA, senior associate. I don't have any other social media or anything like that. So,
that's all you need.
Yeah. But yeah, thanks so much for having me. And I mean, really, really interesting to think about these things that I probably work with every day, but don't always get to think about conceptually. So, yeah, thanks.
Pleasure.